When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
If you haven't heard, it's a good idea to fit probiotics into your daily routine. Fortunately, Nature's Way Women's Probiotic Pearls make that so easy. These adorable little pearls couldn't be easier to take, and they support both digestive and vaginal health, all because of the probiotics. There are actually 1 billion active cultures protecting against occasional bloating, constipation, and digestive discomfort, all in one tiny little pearl. To learn more about Nature's Way Women's Probiotic Pearls and how they can fit into your routine, visit naturesway.com.
Hey, it's Will Friedle.
And Sabrina Bryan.
And we're the hosts of the new podcast, Magical Rewind.
You may know us from some of your favorite childhood TV movies, like My Date with the President's Daughter.
And the Cheetah Girls movies.
Together, we're sitting down to watch all the movies you grew up with and chat with some of your favorite stars and crew that made these iconic movies happen.
So kick back, grab your popcorn, and join us. Listen to Magical Rewind on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott Benjamin.
And I'm Ben Bolin.
And we've got another vehicle today that is from the Dream Cars at the High Museum.
We just can't stop.
I know. There's so many of them. And this particular vehicle is the one, and I don't know if you recall this or not, but We talked about this, maybe even on this podcast, that when you arrive on the floor of the museum, when you pay your money, your admission, And you get into the elevator and you go up to the second floor where this exhibit is, this is the vehicle that you're greeted with as soon as the elevator doors open, and it's breathtaking.
Yeah, it's directly opposite of the elevator doors. Ladies and gentlemen, today we're talking about the Norman Timms Special.
1947. Sometimes you'll hear it called the Buick Special, the Norman Timms Buick Special. There's a reason for that, and we'll talk about that, but just a gorgeous, gorgeous car. I mean, it's sleek. People use sexy when they describe this car.
Yeah, streamlined. It looks as though the entire car is one single piece.
Yeah, like the Stingrays or the fish design vehicles, you know, like the smooth flowing bodies.
Like a polished river stone.
Beautiful. Oh, very good. Yeah, beautiful, beautiful car. So we'll tell you all about this car today, I promise. And there's some real twist to this story because as it appears now, I mean, it's a concours level vehicle. It's beautiful, gorgeous in every way. But it wasn't always that way, and we'll tell you how it reemerged on the car scene very recently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no kidding.
All right, so where do you want to start, Ben?
Why don't we start with Norman?
Okay, sounds good. So Norman, built by Norman Timms, that's why they call it the Norman Timms Special.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a guy from Van Nuys, California.
Yeah, a mechanical engineer, and by the time he begins building the Special, he has already been working on winners of the Indianapolis 500, like the famous Blue Crown Specials.
Interesting, huh? Actually, a couple of winners. I mean, 3 winners in a row, 1947, 1948, mm-hmm. and 1949. And you know, you mentioned the Blue Crown Spark Plug Specials, right?
Right.
These are driven by Bill Holland and Maury Rose. Now, Maury Rose was the driver that was selected to test drive that Firebird 1 test car. Remember they said the engineer that was in charge of the program couldn't handle it.
Mm-hmm.
And they selected Maury Rose because he had Indy 500 experience. This was a car that kind of ties, I don't know how to say this, Ben, it kind of ties these two together, and they're right there on the same floor together at the museum now.
Yeah, which is weird because there's some connective tissue there that you might not know about if you're just strolling through the exhibit. But speaking of connective tissue, I can't believe I buried the lead because you know the connection here that I'm probably the most excited about.
I think I do.
That connection is that, which I totally almost skipped over, was that Norman Timms was not just your ordinary mechanical engineer, your run-of-the-mill automotive engineer. No, sir. He was working with the famous Preston Tucker on Tucker Automobiles.
That's right, the Tucker sedan. He was one of the designers. He was right there in-house with Tucker designing the Tucker Torpedo, the mm-hmm. Tucker 48. So what a cool history this guy has. I mean, so we're talking like late 40s when this guy is really making a name for himself, I guess.
Yeah, his glory days.
Exactly right. So it makes sense that he would kind of break out on his own. And in 1947, I guess this kind of is right around the same time as when he's working with Tucker.
Yeah.
Because Tucker was 48. He decides that he's going to build his own streamlined custom vehicle. And, man, what a cool project, because you know, streamlining was a huge thing back then. It still mm-hmm. is, you know, it's around.
It comes and goes to these days.
Yeah, it really does. But, you know, it's big at Bonneville. It's big, you know, for mm-hmm. land speed records, mm-hmm. things like that. But streamlining, we talk about aerodynamics, sure, but not streamlining. And streamlining is such a cool art form almost, really. The people
yeah.
that make streamlined vehicles are just unbelievable in what they do. They're remarkable.
Can I make a comparison?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so let's think of just aerodynamic form and design as the science of the concept, but streamlining is more the aesthetic or the art.
Sure, yeah, it's the two combined, right?
Yeah.
So you have to know what you're doing ahead of time, and then you have to make it look beautiful, right?
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to make it look beautiful, but in this case, he did, because he's trying to build a road-going vehicle. He wants something that is something he could drive every day, and that's mm-hmm. what he did. Now, it took him 3 years to build the Norman Tim Special, and
yep.
A lot went into this. Now, remember, he had this engineering background. So there's a process that he followed for the Special. And it started out with some detailed chassis drawings, which makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Then he moved on to quarter scale clay models.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there were several body styles that he actually worked on for that.
Right. Yeah. He had more than one clay model, a couple different variations on the theme of the body. And eventually, He found little pieces of each model that he favored, and he combined all of those principles into a single wooden model. And then, Scott, he made an aluminum body for the car by hand on this model, just forming it around the wood.
Yeah, isn't that cool? So he made, you know, kind of a skeleton form that you would be familiar with. You've seen a wooden buck vehicle, I guess is what
yeah,
they call it, right?
Yeah.
And then he started forming these aluminum panels all over the wooden frame, you know, hand forming them, getting them together. And then he had to weld the pieces together and, you know, of course, grind them down, smooth them out and form them again. Cause, you know, I'm sure that, you know, in the forming process, the heat or whatever he used to,
right.
to do so would warp them a bit. So, he was a real craftsman, this guy. And, there's so much to this vehicle, Ben. I think they said that he was inspired by, or it was possibly inspired by, some of the Auto Union cars from that era. Like 1937 Auto Union Type C, which was driven by Bernard Rosemeyer. Unfortunately, I think that's the car that he died in, you know, making a world speed record run on the Autobahn, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, he was inspired, I think, by that design, because I've seen a lot of places, a lot of articles that point to that vehicle as kind of being the genesis for the idea of the Norman Tim Special, and you can see the lines in it. I think you really can,
but it's not the only one. There's also the Mercedes-Benz W25 Avis Grand Prix,
mm-hmm.
And then you can definitely see, I guess, what today we would call the DNA of the Type C in the Special itself. But let's go into when he actually makes the vehicle, because he goes from this little wooden model, and mm-hmm. I can't call it little, this fourth size model,
mm-hmm.
to something that's darn near 18 and a half feet long.
17 and a half.
Sorry. I meant darn near 18 feet long, 17 and a half feet long.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. The only reason I'm clarifying that is because the proportions of this thing are so important, because when you do look at the Auto Union Type C vehicle, you're going to see those proportions in the same vehicle, because
yeah.
the driver sits in a really odd position. They sit almost right on top of the front axle,
mm-hmm.
and then the way that the rest of the chassis is set up is so unusual. The engine is directly behind the driver's seat,
yep.
and then there's a spare tire behind that, and then there's a good deal of distance to the very back end of the vehicle. It's a long, long tail on this thing, and there's a small front end, and that contains a, well, it's got a hood, but it also contains
right.
a luggage compartment.
A trunk,
I guess.
Yeah, and there is a spare tire. It's just under, it's hidden under that enormous tail.
It's way, way at the back of the vehicle. I mean, the fuel tank's back there, the engine's back there, the spare tire's back there, and all this is laying flat. So it gives you an idea of the distance between the driver and the back end of this vehicle. It's very strange.
Yeah, the proportion is, it's not unique, but it would be unique today.
Yeah, I think so. The thing weighs about 2,500 pounds, even though there's a lot of aluminum and, you know, aircraft type tubing on this thing. But the engine, we need to talk about the engine for just a second.
Oh yeah, that 1948 Buick Straight 8.
That's right. And that's where the Buick Special comes in. That's why they call it sometimes. You'll see it listed as the Buick Special. And apparently that was a crate engine that was ordered from a Los Angeles auto dealer, a Buick dealer at the time. And this actually had a couple of features that came from earlier Buicks, Ben. So, one thing that it had was, dual carbs, something that they called compound carburetors that were offered on Buicks from around 1941. So, this is something that's, you know, 5 or 6 years old at this point, but, interesting feature that he would, you know, kind of add on, I suppose, to this crate engine. And, the other thing is that a lot of the other running equipment, you know, the other stuff that's below the beautiful body on the
thing
is pure mercury. So mercury,
steering.
Yeah. So the division of Ford, Mercury, which had only been around since about 1938. It was formed by Edsel Ford. And, I guess, you know, it was something that was available, you know, so the, you mentioned, the brakes, you mentioned,
the steering as well.
Yeah, that's right. And what's most unusual maybe about this whole thing is that when you look at it, you know, it's enormous body on this thing.
Yeah.
It's only two pieces.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together, we'll cry together, and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
It's so weird because, okay, if you look at the photos, you can see the seam, right, Scott? Right there behind the driver's seat.
Exactly right. It's a hinged seam behind the driver's side. So it's almost like a clamshell rear end that opens up to expose the engine, the fuel tank, and the spare tire.
Mm-hmm.
It's a massive, massive piece. I mean, it's very, very heavy. And I think that I think there's a note here somewhere that it was originally hydraulically operated. Mm-hmm. He had a hydraulic pump that was, they said it was a little too strong for it. And I think somewhere along the way that went away. But we'll get to that when we get to the bit about restoration. How about that?
Perfect. One note about the body, however, is that just to underline, how extraordinary this body was. We said it took Tim's about 3 years to complete this car, stem to stern, and it cost him around $10,000.
Ah, 10 grand. Now, 10 grand in, what year was that? 1947?
Yes, sir.
All right. I've done the inflation calculator.
Oh, thank you.
Unless you've already got it.
You know, I got to be honest, you're always so consistent with it that I just kind of, it's a trust fall. I assume that you will have it.
And you're right, Ben. I do have it. So, I did do an inflation calculator calculation on this, you know, for current market value, I guess. And $10,000 in 1947 would equal $106,880.27 in 2014.
Oh, man.
So that is a pile of money for someone to pour into a project, you know, like a garage project, right?
Wow. That is so much money.
That is a lot of money. Now, that figure, that $10,000 figure, comes from a Mechanics Illustrated article that was written about this vehicle back in 1949. So, you know, that was from him. He said it's about this much, but you can say that it was about $106,000 for this project for him to complete in his garage.
But even though it is technically a garage project, before I forget the side note, of that $10,000, Scott, the majority of the expense was the body.
Oh, I would completely understand that.
Aluminum in the 1940s.
Yeah. It's a difficult material to work with. So, as far as welding and you know, smoothing, I mean, the body guys could tell you all about this. I really can't. Yeah. I've heard that it's a difficult process. And because they're so large, there was a lot of problem with warping. And if you had introduced any kind of heat to the thing, which I'm sure that they had to, you know, doing some of this welding and some of the forming. I think it was a really, really difficult body to put together on this thing. A very, a grand project to take on.
Yeah, no kidding. And also, let's go ahead and consider this, my friends, you, Scott, and listeners there at home or in your cars. Maybe that's why Mercury and Buick are all over the interior of the car, because maybe there was so much money on the body.
Could be that
he said, you know, I don't have time to get a. Now, don't get me wrong, that Buick Straight 8 is a nice engine.
Yeah, but he wasn't going for like the Duesenberg chassis.
Exactly.
Yeah, I understand. Exactly. Okay, so it was, he was going for availability of parts, things like that. Maybe something that could be consistent. Because I think there was a plan to have a series of vehicles. You know, that was the intent of this. It wasn't so much that he wanted to build one car and that was it. I think the original idea was, I'm going to build more than this, but here's the initial one, the prototype. It just never went beyond that.
Proof of concept. Now, if we go back to where that interview, right, Mechanics Illustrated in 49, he did have a good interview there. And here's why I don't think it's fair, really, for us to just call this a garage project. Because Norman Tim's garage project blows up in the same year. It's on the cover of Motor Trend magazine.
Oh, and this was a big, big deal, right?
It's the second issue.
Yeah, Motor Trend. I mean, think about this. Now, Motor Trend is a staple on the newsstands now, right?
I mean,
it's always there.
Yeah.
This was, again, October 1949. This is the second ever issue of Motor Trend. So this is kind of it's a remarkable time in history, I guess, for this thing to be on the cover. It's a big deal. Mm-hmm. So it was called the Buick Special, I guess, when it was featured on the cover as well.
Yeah.
So, and the article title that goes along with it was called Homemade Streamliner. And there's a little bit of, not controversy, but, you know, people kind of chuckle when they read this because, you know, it's not much of an article. It's a very short article, but, you know, when they say Homemade Streamliner, they give this kind of like a false hope that anybody could, you know, maybe create something like this at their own house, right?
I mean, yeah, believe in yourself, follow your dreams, but it is tough.
Well, you've seen all those articles, you know, like, you know, build your own hovercraft type stuff and, you know, make your own, sailing vessel or whatever, you know.
Submarine.
Yeah, submarine. That was another good one. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the idea that you could just come out, throw this together in your garage was kind of absurd, and they were only giving you a little bit of hope that maybe it's possible. I don't think they mentioned in Motor Trend that it cost him 10 grand in 1947.
No, that's in Mechanics.
Yeah, but they did call it a little workbench project, which I thought was kind of funny. I mean, that was a quote, a little workbench project. Now, that's maybe the wrong way to describe this, but you're right in saying that, you know, this thing kind of blew up because mentioned 1947 is when he finished it. There were a couple of, you know, magazine articles, auto magazine articles around 1949.
Mm-hmm.
Well, by 1950, I don't know if he needed money or what, but he decided that he was done with this whole thing, and he advertised it for sale in Road and Track magazine in the February 1950 edition for about $7,500. Now, I didn't do the calculation for that because I just found that information today. but it had a claimed top speed of something in excess of 100 miles per hour, and he claimed that there was less than 5,000 miles on the odometer at that point. So that's 1950. And then we'll kind of step through the 1950s here with some more history.
Ah, yes. Okay, so this is where someone else enters the story, the new owner of the Tim Special, and that would be an Air Force officer named Jim Davis. Now, Jim lived in Manhattan Beach, California, and there's a little bit of misinformation that comes into play because the car surfaces again in the magazines of record. It surfaces in the mid-50s, about 1954, in an issue of Motor Life.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And he's painted the car white, and he says that someone else made it.
Yeah, he says the guy. Now, this just could be, you know, misunderstanding.
Sure.
It could be a misprint, whatever.
It probably is just.
But they consistently in this article call Norman Timms. They call him Larry Tim.
Mm-hmm.
Or wait, no, Larry Tim.
Yeah, right. T-I-M-M.
T-I-M-M. So they call him Larry Tim. So that's a little bit of misinformation there. But again, this is years on past, you know, whenever the ownership transferred. And I don't know if there's anybody in between this Captain Jim Davis and or the Officer Jim Davis and, Norman Timms himself.
I don't know if there was, but we do know that when Davis bought the car, it was in 1952, and again, according to this Motor Life article, Davis was the first person to register the car.
Yeah, for road use, right?
Right, yeah.
Okay, so, all right, yeah, so there's some interesting twists and turns going on in the story. You know, after this this Motor Life magazine article in 1954, you know, of course, Air Force officer Jim Davis had owned it for about 2 years at this point. He lives in Manhattan Beach, California, by the way, lived, I should say, in Manhattan Beach. And there's kind of an unusual twist to this whole thing. Now, right around the same time, the car was featured in an episode of Buck Rogers, which is really cool. How neat is that? I mean, interesting bit of television history, I guess. But you'll also find that now there are a few subsequent owners that own this thing, and it went through some really dark days, I guess, if you want to say that way.
Yeah.
It was displayed for many years outside of a place called the Halfway House Restaurant in Saugus, California, and they say that children would run and play on this thing, on the body of this thing. Now, remember, it's aluminum.
Right.
So kids running all over it, you can imagine that it just mangled the body, smashed it down pretty flat.
Uh-huh.
It was used kind of like a bit of playground equipment.
Yeah, a lawn sculpture even.
Yeah, that's a better way to say it, maybe. And the kids would just kind of play on this and have a good time, you know, before or they're waiting for a table or whatever for the restaurant. And I guess it was even like there was even an indented area where they would run up the very long back end of this car.
Right. That tail
and hop into the driver's seat. And they said there's like a clear indentation where the kids would run up the back tail of this thing.
Plus the paint coating is gone. Mm-hmm. This is almost just bare gunmetal gray.
Yeah.
They've cut holes. Okay. This is what gets me.
Oh.
They cut holes in the rear of the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, to expose the engine and the rear wheels. This thing looks like garbage, ladies and gentlemen.
It really does.
And it continues to look like garbage until, 2000, 2002?
Well, yeah. Now here's the other part of this is that, you know, after it goes through all this, I don't know if it goes through even any more owners or what, but it somehow ends up in the high desert of California. Antelope Valley, California.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows up in the background, I guess, of a few scenes, or maybe a scene. I'm not sure how much, really. I didn't look into this, but and Gone in 60 Seconds.
Starring Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, the later version of Gone in 60
right.
Seconds. It shows up for just, they said, a few frames, I guess. So it's out there in the desert somewhere. Somebody there on the set of that production buys the car because it says it went to a Hollywood Studios prop guy, you know, who bought it. And said, you know, I'd like to buy this, the Streamliner body. He decides then that he's going to take it to, LA and he's going to sell it at the Peterson Museum Automotive Auction.
Right.
You know, the yearly auction that they have, or the, I don't know if they do it anymore or not, but they had an auction at the Peterson Museum.
Specifically for classic cars.
Exactly right. So he bought this thing and he brings it there and, you know, he's thinking like, I'm going to make a fortune on this thing. And I think that the auction was run by Barrett Jackson.
Yes.
So the one guy kind of gets a hint that this thing is going to happen. The guy's name is Gary Cervani.
Mm-hmm.
And he won the auction. And this is in, what, 2002, Ben?
Yeah, it was in 2002. He won the auction for $17,600.
$17,600. Now, I did another calculation, Ben.
And oh, okay.
Not that's really necessary, but I figured, you know, there's been about 12 years that's passed. So
yeah.
In 2002, $17,600 was just that. But now in 2014, it'd be about $23,317. So it's gone up, but not significantly.
Runaway inflation, Scott.
Still a deal. Still a deal, right?
I guess, yeah. So you're right. No, you're right. I'm just being cheap.
And it's bought by this guy, this Gary guy, who is from Malibu, California. Mm-hmm. He has a wife. Her name is Diane Cervani. And again, both from Malibu. And they've decided that they're going to restore this thing. Now, I think Gary has some interest in this, or has some background in this, because he had restored a belly tank racer, you know, for the Bonneville Salt Flats.
Yeah.
And had done so successfully. You know, it was an easy project for him. Not easy, but he had completed the project. Bought this thinking he could do the same thing. And he really kind of on the way realized, I can't really do anything with this body because it's aluminum and it's very frail and it's very difficult to work with. But he did continue to do, you know, like he did the engine.
Yeah, he did the drivetrain too.
Yeah, he did the drivetrain. He did, I think, the suspension, you know, the chassis work on himself. But then he did have to farm out the body work.
Yeah, to a Custom Auto in Loveland, Colorado. They had some advantages though, because when he got the car, it was about 90% original. Mm-hmm. So there had already been some work done.
Very fortunate.
Right. Custom Auto was there to tackle some of, as you said, Scott, the really tough body work. So those halves of the body that we had mentioned earlier, they had been bolted together, I imagine, so that the kids couldn't open it.
Yeah. And you mentioned the holes already, right? So somebody had decided that, you know, I remember earlier I mentioned the hydraulic lift for that tail section.
Yeah.
The clamshell thing.
Yeah.
I guess that back end, even though it's aluminum, is very, very heavy because there's a framework underneath it as well. So you go to lift that and it'll wear you out. Well, the mechanical part of that had broken down, you know, the hydraulic lift.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together, we'll cry together, and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
And so you would have to manually lift that up. And the one of the owners along the way decided, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to cut an access hole in the body for the engine. And I'm going to cut an access hole in the body to get to those back wheels because they're completely covered. If you look at the if you look at the current state of the vehicle, you'll see that they're totally covered with one piece. And you would have to lift the back end to be able to access those.
And that matches the original pictures from the 50s articles.
Yeah. And, you know, while we're talking about that, this is an interesting point, I think, to bring up about the paint. Now, all those photos in those magazines that we see, it's kind of a dark colored vehicle, right?
Yeah, and they're all black and white photos.
That's the problem. They're all black and white, and no one really knows what the color of that thing was, right? So we know that when Jim Davis, is that the name? Jim Davis, the Air Force officer, he painted the vehicle white. So that was easy enough, right? We understand that. But what color was it prior to that? No one really knew.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out there was a, I guess he had a kid. Norman Timms had a son, and I guess his name was Norman Jr. And they found Norman Jr., and Norman Jr. said, well, my dad also built me a go-kart in the day.
Oh, okay.
And he painted the go-kart the same color as he painted that old special car that he used to work on, I remember. So they took a paint chip from the go-kart that Norman Jr. had because they were able to track that down somehow.
Wow.
They found a small paint chip from that.
Yeah.
And then they custom mixed the exact color of the original Norman Timms special. So they were able to do that from just that one little chip. Now, this body shop in Loveland, Colorado, I mean, they do this kind of thing. So they go to these levels for restoration. You know, they do this regularly. This is like a Concours level restoration. I guess it's a... described as a like a red maroon finish with a gold metal flake, and they finally decided on the exact shade, the exact bit of metal, you know, amount of metal flake to put in this thing to make it exactly like the original.
Right, and when you see the vehicle, it is a striking deep red. But again, to be fair, it may be difficult to differentiate between the body and the color because with a car like that, almost, I'm not going to say every, almost any color would look really, really good on it.
I think so. I think you're right. Now, I mean, the color really does play into this thing. I mean, it's gorgeous, the color that they've chosen. But that was, you know, Norman's decision back in 1947 to paint it that color, and that's what they stuck with. And again, you know, this Customs Auto place in Colorado, this is the pains that they go to. The guy's name is David, I think it's Krause. Who owns this place. And he does this type of restoration work, you know, for Concours type vehicles. And that's where they decide that this thing is going to make its first appearance. Now, if you go back and look at any of these photos of this car when it was in the desert in 2002, I mean, as recent as 2002,
right?
You would never, ever guess that by 2010, that's when they decided to reveal this thing. 2010, this was going to be a show winner at Amelia Island in the Concours event.
Yes, sir. It won the RM Auctions Trophy for the best open car. So from the junkyard to the Jubilee, really, this is amazing that it became probably the most improved. If there was an MVP award or most improved award for classic cars, it would have won this year.
Yeah, but you see, here's the thing. You know, this Concours, if you go to a Concours event, I've been to several of these.
Right.
There are so many stories similar to this. You know, like, this car was at the bottom of Lake Erie for 3 years before I found it. And now look at it. It's a show winner. You know, it's $17 million for this thing.
Yeah.
You know, that type of thing happens. I mean, that's a dramatic example. But what I'm saying is when you look at the photos of this thing in the desert back in, you know, 2002, you'll never ever guess that it's the same body, even because it was so, you know, kind of squished down, I guess.
Right. It's sitting there, deformed.
It's sitting there without wheels.
Yeah.
No bumpers. I mean, you know, when they went to great, great lengths to restore this thing, finding the original hubcaps, things like that. And they would wait years for parts to become available and put, you know, a lot of time and effort into the restoration, you know, the correct restoration of those parts when they did find them. So it's an amazing, amazing process. And now, you know, this car, what it does is it travels all over the, you know, the U.S. at least, if not the world, I'm not sure. But it participates in these, I guess you call them prestigious shows.
Right, yeah, the Customs Then and Now exhibit, the Grand National Roadster Show, and so on.
And, of course, it's invited to the Concours events.
Right.
It does very well there. It's always highly awarded whenever it goes anywhere.
Not just Amelia Island, you guys, Pebble Beach as well.
Yeah, so it, it travels, and it does very, very well. And, you know, it's just a lot of people say when they see this car, even, you know, on a field of other multi-million dollar vehicles, this is the one that makes them stop dead in their tracks and, you know, inhale a breath, you know, because it's just, it's so striking when you see it in person. It really is a beautiful, beautiful design. I'm glad we were able to see it in person, stand next to it, walk around it a bit, because that, you know, again, this High Museum of Art exhibit, this Dream Cars thing,
right,
is just, it's incredible. It's a beautiful, beautiful exhibit. And the nice thing about it is it's not just one weekend. It's hanging around until like the middle of September.
Mm-hmm.
And they've extended the show. And I know that shows like this happen, you know, at other museums around the country. I've been looking up some of the stuff that we could maybe get to in a car, you know, like on
right.
a short day trip or something. And there's little pockets of this here and there, but I feel fortunate to be able to have seen this one in person.
We still have to get down to that drag racing museum.
Definitely, the Don Garlitz museum.
Yeah, yeah. So one thing that we do need to point out is that you guys have heard us say a couple of times that it originally, the Tim Special originally had a hydraulic lift. The car itself has not been completely, it's not 100% the way it was originally, right?
Yeah, that's right. There's a few changes here and there.
Mm-hmm. One of those changes, I believe, is the hydraulic lift, right? Like, that's no longer on there.
Yeah, that's right. Now there's an electric motor screw jack is what they call it. So it's an electric device that that lifts up that great big body piece in the back. Let's see, what else is, oh, there was other, something else about the frame. I think originally, this is so strange, he had pressurized the framework. You know, he had sealed it off and pressurized it. And I kind of want to say it was with nitrogen, but I just can't remember what he pressurized it
mm-hmm.
with. So it was supposed to strengthen the design. Now, someone who looked at it recently, you know, someone who, I think the guys that restored it said, you know, this is a great idea. It's very advanced, you know, to think this way, especially back in 1947.
Sure.
But they said that it would take something like 1,000 PSI in order to really feel any difference in a pressurized tube frame versus, you know, just leaving it empty.
Oh, to make the difference they wanted to make.
To make it stiffer, yeah, because that's what he's attempting to do, is make it a stiffer framework by pressurizing it.
Yeah.
And great idea, but it would require so much pressure, pressure that he probably didn't have in 1947, you know, be able to put 1,000 PSI in that thing to make it feel any different.
Yeah.
So good idea, but maybe not the best execution.
And plus, let me just be the Murphy's Law advocate here to point out what would happen if, God forbid, that 1,000 PSI seal was broken.
Maybe. Mm. I mean, what do you think? A pinhole leak, maybe? Something like that?
Pinhole? I don't know.
What would it do? I don't know. I'm not sure if that would cause any kind of damage or not, if it would just leak out and you'd never know it was missing.
Hmm.
I don't know. You'd probably hear it.
Oh, man, that would be maddening.
17 and a half feet of tubing, you know, that...
I can't,
you know,
deal with lots the of idea of that, trying to find that.
And the other thing is that they converted it from 6 volts to a 12-volt system. A lot of vehicles back then were 6-volt systems, so it makes perfect sense they would up to a 12-volt system now.
Now, I think we're reaching the end of the show here, Scott, but I just have to say for the record, I am still startled this thing can hit 120 miles an hour.
That's pretty amazing. I mean,
that's the stat we hear the most.
How cool would that be to be in this thing cruising at that speed? That would be, it feels so cool. It's such a long, low vehicle. I mean, you mentioned 17 and a half feet. I think something about, I read where the body itself is only like 39 inches tall.
Right.
That's
so
without the windshield.
With the windshield, it's 47 inches or
something.
Okay,
so it's still extremely,
it's very low.
Extremely low, wide, long. It's a great looking car.
You're just sliding down the road.
Definitely.
And I would love to see more of this vehicle in action, but this car in particular made me realize even more the importance of keeping your eye out for every hunk of metal that you see. Because, again, we cannot emphasize this enough, guys. 2002, I guess, to 2010, so 8 years. 8 years it took to restore this thing, more than worth it. And the next piece of steel rusting in a field that you pass could very well be something like this.
You know, I don't know how many times we're going to read stories like this in the near future. I mean, because it's happened that, you know, there's somebody in a news helicopter or something and catches a glimpse of a vehicle in a junkyard somewhere or out in a field somewhere. You know, something like that happens.
Right.
Or a private pilot catches their attention.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, that's an unusual shape. I'm going to go check it out when I get down on the ground. And they go do, and it's like, a Motorama car or something. And it's worth $500,000 the way it is. Restore it. It's worth $4 million or $5 million or whatever. That happens occasionally. It doesn't happen often, but it does happen. And this is another case where it was just a diamond in the rough that somebody saw, you know, on a movie set and said, wait a minute, this is way out of place. There's got to be a story behind this.
Yeah, so keep your eyes open, ladies and gentlemen, because who knows what that next little glint off in the forest might be.
I mean, this is just something that had just disappeared for, you know, decades, and it just came back. And now it's making the circuit. You know, it's on the circuit of these prestigious exhibits and tours and everything.
Sure.
I don't know, it's just remarkable how something like that happens. It just goes away and then comes back, and it comes back in a big way.
It was reborn almost, or actually kind of literally reborn. Yeah. Scott, speaking of saving cars, before we call it a day on this episode of Car Stuff, I've got a special piece of listener mail for us. You want to hear it?
I'd like to hear it.
Okay, great, because honestly, man, I don't know what I would have done if you had said, nah.
Close it out right now.
Close it out. We're out of here. Okay, Scott, Caleb S. writes to us, and Caleb says, hey, Scott and Ben, I'm a new listener but really enjoy your podcast. Binge listened to many episodes over the summer. I'm very interested in cars, more specifically how they work, not really how cool they look. I'm a younger listener, 15, and I do not have too much experience tinkering with cars. I've played around with small engines from lawnmowers and the like, but never been able to really mess with a car engine, just changing the oil and rotating tires, etc. To gain more experience with cars, I've been looking into purchasing a salvage car. Not in terrible condition like flood or fire damage, but something that just needs some good tinkering and parts replacements to fix it up. I was wondering if you guys have any ideas on how much it would cost to fix up a salvage car. I would just want to purchase a low-end salvage car like a Honda Civic or another common car so the parts are easy to find. Thanks for the great podcast, Caleb.
Oh, boy, Caleb.
Oh, Caleb.
Caleb, here's my advice. Please do not buy a salvage vehicle. I mean, I just think that you'd be better off if you just bought a cheaper kind of a POS car that you could find in your local classified somewhere. I would say stay away from a salvage vehicle because you're going to have trouble getting rid of it on the other end. That's one thing. The other thing is that there's always so many hidden. I mean, there's a reason that it's total.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason that the insurance company said, we're not going to pay to fix this because it's not worth it. I know you're saying you just want to tinker with something. I get that.
Right. But the things that could be the things that could be broken about it may interfere with even your ability to tinker and experiment. And so it is a little better. It's a better idea to get a used POS. And of course, on Car Stuff, when we say POS, we mean pretty old stuff.
Of course.
Yeah.
Family show.
To get one of those cars, because the first things that I want to say, Caleb, you are making some really smart decisions already. The idea to get a Honda Civic or another common car so that you can have the parts readily available, that is very smart. Also, the idea that Caleb is so much more responsible than I was when I was 15, because you've gone through the small engines, right? And you're building up toward the actual, toward the automobile engine. A used car that still runs, or even a car that has some problems, would be great. And I think it would be worth your time, too, because just like Scott's saying, and I'm agreeing with you here, Scott, the problem with a salvage car is that not only do you have no idea what could be going on with it, but it really could be so bad that you are not able to tinker with it.
Yeah, that's right. And when you do what repairs that you think are necessary, there may be something deeper, and it could be a safety issue. I mean, there's a reason that the insurance companies have totaled that vehicle. So, you know, Ben's right. Just pick up the local classifieds, or, you know, search the local classifieds, I guess.
Yeah.
And find something that's just a couple $100.
Mm-hmm.
Those are out there.
Oh, yeah.
Especially the ones that, you know, are having mechanical problems. And that's what you're looking for.
Right.
Just look for a car with a clean title that has mechanical problems that you can then tackle in your garage. Because you're not even driving yet. You've got a chance to work on this stuff. You know, there's no pressure, no time pressure.
You know, I think Caleb might not be even looking for a car to drive. Just something to tinker with.
Exactly right. And you still don't want to have a salvage vehicle parked on your property and have to deal with any kind of the extra paperwork and hassle that a salvage vehicle comes with. You just don't want to have to deal with this.
Yeah, or can you imagine working on something a lot of times if people are tinkering with an engine, then the whole end goal is, can I get this puppy running again?
Yeah, exactly.
And imagine finding something where the damage is so extensive that halfway through you realize the only way to get this running again is to buy a new engine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, something like that that's major, major, major work that you really can't do in your own garage. The other thing is that, I mentioned this already, I think, but, you know, just a couple $100, you can find vehicles relatively cheap. I mean, I say relatively because, you know, not buying new.
And common vehicles, too.
Again, common vehicles. But, you know, look in the $400 range or something like that.
Right.
You know, keep it low, and I think it's a smart decision.
And if it's got a lot of miles on it, that's okay, too, because then you'll be able to have some really great tinkering with new parts and old parts and see the wear on them, read the spark plugs and stuff, which is still a really cool thing. Caleb, thank you so much for writing this email to us. And listeners, we hope that you'll weigh in with some advice for Caleb as well. And let's make a deal here. If you do decide to pick up a used car, send us some pictures. We'd love to keep track of this and see what you find.
Oh, definitely. Like the condition it's in now and the condition that it's in when you're done with it, you know,
yeah.
When you're ready to drive. So
absolutely.
It'd be interesting to see the progression.
Yeah, you can't beat it before and after, right? So we're going to go ahead and head out for today. We hope that you enjoyed this episode as much as we enjoyed pulling a fanboy about the Tim special. So write to us. Let us know what you think. You can find us at CarStuffHSW on both Facebook and Twitter. We have our very own website where you can find all of our podcasts, carstuffshow.com, and you can take a page from Caleb's book and send us an email directly. We are
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.
What's up, y'all? Janice Torres here.
And I'm Austin Hankwitz.
We're the hosts of Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories, a podcast presented by iHeartRadio's Ruby Studios and Intuit QuickBooks. Join us as we speak with small business owners about the tools they use to turn their ideas into success.
From finding that initial spark of entrepreneurship to organizing payments and invoices, we've got you covered. So follow and listen to Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode brought to you by 20th Century Studios' Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Director Wes Ball breathes new life into the epic franchise. As a ruthless king attempts to build his empire at the expense of the remaining human race, a young ape begins a journey to fight for a future for apes and humans alike. Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Enter the kingdom in IMAX on May 10th and theaters everywhere. Get tickets now.
Managing your diabetes just got easier. The powerful new Dexcom G7 lets you see your glucose numbers on your compatible watch and phone without finger sticks. And because Dexcom G7 is the most accurate CGM system, you can be confident in your food, exercise, and medication decisions. And all those decisions can lead to big results, like more time in range and lower A1C. Get started at Dexcom.com.
Dexcom data on file 2023. If your glucose alerts and readings from the G7 do not match symptoms or expectations, use a blood glucose meter to make diabetes treatment decisions. For a list of compatible devices, visit Dexcom.com/compatibility.